This is the Late Round Podcast with your host, JJ Zacharisa.
What's up, everyone? It's JJ Zacharyson, the editor-in-chief over at NumberFire.com, and this is episode 95 of the Late Round Podcast, one of the many shows that are part of the NumberFire Podcast Network. Thanks for tuning in. Probably like 4 or 5 years ago, I went on a rampage writing articles about coaching changes and the impact that those coaches will have on their new teams. Specifically, I looked at a lot of head coaching changes. Now, I have no idea if my analysis ended up predicting the futures of those coaches correctly, but over the last couple of years, I can tell you that my views on head coaches in general have changed quite a bit. I think it's important to find a coach who succeeded in his previous role. You don't want to hire some failure, just like you don't want to hire someone at a company who doesn't have a strong track record. But I think what good coaches do, especially good coaches who don't have a ton of experience, is the same thing that a good manager does in the more standard work environment. They know how to surround themselves with people who do certain things better than they do, and they delegate properly and trust that those people are going to get the job done. That's what made Sean McVay such a good coach this year. He focused on the offense, he did the things that he does best, and he delegated properly elsewhere. So when I see people criticizing head coaching hires because certain guys have maybe just an above average track record as coordinators instead of elite ones, I think that's kind of misguided. We don't really know. We don't know their ability to lead and delegate. We don't know what they're like as managers. I bring this up because that can also sometimes make it tough from a fantasy football perspective. If coaches fail because they're control freaks who don't know how to give up certain parts of the team, then that can impact players in fantasy football. And this also ties loosely to the first couple of questions that I received for this week's mailbag episode. This first one is from @KRMoneyFire. How much do coaching changes affect your projections and your evaluation of a situation? Seems to be more than usual this year. Now, there's no clear-cut blanket answer that I can give to this, but I'd be lying if I told you that I completely ignored a coach's history when projecting player outputs for an upcoming campaign. There are coaches who tend to do the same thing wherever they are. Bruce Arians, for instance, runs a vertical, high-variance passing attack. It's what he did in Pittsburgh, it's what he did in Indianapolis, and it's what he did in Arizona. So it would be silly for me to just ignore that if he ended up getting a new gig. I'm also far more concerned about coaches who call plays. If they're not calling plays, then you're not getting a full glimpse of team tendencies, like how run-heavy or pass-heavy an offense might be. But I do tend to believe that fantasy analysts sometimes put too much stock into coaching tendencies, for a lot of reasons. First, plenty of coaches morph their styles to fit the team's personnel. Many don't, but many do too. And second, play calling is often dictated by game script. If a team's defense is horrendous, then they're probably going to have a pretty pass-friendly offense. So overall, I definitely factor in coaching when looking at projections, but I also do my best to not overstate the impact from a projection standpoint that a coach might have on a player. Instead, I'll be open to the fact that the coach himself may really transform the team into a hopefully better offense. This next one is also from Twitter, from @BethanyLPeters. What is your take on coaching honesty? Should we ever listen to them? For example, I was burned by drafting Isaiah Crowell in the 3rd round because I heard Hugh Jackson say that he wishes he had utilized him more in 2016 and he planned to feature him more this season. So I'm going to do a little promotion of the podcast here, but I think looking back and listening to episode 35 with Adam Schefter from earlier in the offseason may help with this question. Essentially, the way that I look at things and the way that Adam described it in that podcast before the season started is to look at the actions, not listen to the words. This is what really got me on Kareem Hunt early in the summer. Hunt was strong in my prospect model, but he got a huge bump when the Chiefs traded up into the 3rd round to select him. They spent a relatively high equity pick for a running back, and they traded up to do so. You can see this with investments elsewhere too. If a team pours money into an offensive line over the offseason, as long as that team has decent quarterback play, you should probably expect them to be fairly run heavy, especially if those offensive linemen are run-friendly offensive linemen. And you should note that they want to at least be a run-heavy team. Coach speak is fine to absorb and listen to, in my opinion, but you have to sort of be level-headed about it. You can't get too high or too low, and you've got to look at the actions that teams are making to build their rosters. That's the most important thing. And that's generally how I approach it. The next one I had to shorten a bit because it was too long to read on the show, but it's actually about Kareem Hunt, and I already talked about part of that answer. But here goes. It says, "Hey, JJ. After re-listening to one of your first podcast episodes with Matt Kelly," which, if you guys are unaware, Matt Kelly hosts another fantasy football podcast, "I noticed that Kareem Hunt wasn't mentioned at all. Please don't quote me on that. He didn't seem to be one of the sleeper running backs to watch in the NFL draft. Kareem Hunt's profile doesn't look good, to be honest. His agility score is super low, and his college dominator isn't that impressive either, even though he played against weaker opponents compared to the other elite running backs. What do you think of Hunt, not just fantasy related, compared to the other workhorse running backs like Fournette, Cook, or Mixon, who might be more talented than him? Is Hunt a no-brainer first-round pick for next year, or just a one-year rookie season wonder and a product of his strong offensive line play in the first and last games of the season? Thank you for all the info that you put out there and getting me to the championship week. Greetings from Germany once again, Daniel. All right, so there's a lot to unpack here, but let me first comment on the first part, which is the lack of Kareem Hunt mentions on that specific podcast episode. The show was done before the draft, and as I noted, I became a Kareem Hunt truther post-draft. And the reason for that is twofold. Number one, he did rank fairly well in my prospect model as an above-average prospect who had pretty decent college production, especially as a receiver out of the backfield. And that's a trait that I love to see in running back prospects. But the second reason is probably the most important one. Situation matters. Situation matters a ton. Anyone who says that situation is meaningless is a bad fantasy football player. I will 1,000,000% change the way that I feel about a prospect if he falls to the right spot. Alvin Kamara, for instance, needed to be an outlier in order to be a top-notch NFL running back. He had horrific rushing attempt market share numbers in college because he was sharing a backfield and wasn't seeing the most volume on his own team. So despite him being a freak athlete, I wasn't as high on him just generally as a running back prospect pre-draft. And then he landed in New Orleans, and I loved him in New Orleans. He's a receiving back, and New Orleans loves to feed their running backs through the air. It was a perfect match for a player who was a freak athlete. So my view on Alvin Kamara changed immediately. So with Kareem Hunt, I certainly wasn't low on him by any means before the draft, but the draft itself got me on him a lot more. I looked at the team's actions, I diagnosed their situation, and I saw an opening for Kareem Hunt, even with a healthy Spencer Ware. And that's why I was higher than other analysts on Hunt in June and July and August this year. So to your other question about how he stacks up with the other running backs, I think he's right there with them. And I think he showed us that he's a very talented running back. That's the thing too, you guys. With prospecting, we're going to be wrong so much because it's such a tough thing to dissect. So if we know we're going to be wrong with prospecting, it doesn't make much sense to only look at how you viewed guys as a prospect when they actually are doing well in the NFL, even if we only have a one-year sample. Like, imagine if we did that with Antonio Brown. He wasn't a special prospect. Now he's the best receiver in football and pacing to be in the Hall of Fame. You can't just assume a player's good season is fluky if they were a bad prospect, because bad prospects thrive in the NFL all the time. And it's because it's hard to evaluate these players. And it's not like Kareem Hunt was even a bad prospect either. He was a good prospect. We've seen Kareem Hunt do well at the NFL level, and he deserves to be in that tier with those other rookie class of 2017 backs at this point. I think in the short term, the most interesting storyline with Hunt will be how the Chiefs handle Spencer Ware, but don't forget that Ware himself was a bad prospect. This next one is from Twitter, @Chris_Rhyme. I can keep max four forever. I have Aaron Rodgers, Kamara, Hunt, Evans, and Gronk. I'm a big Packers fan. Who do I drop, Mr. Late Round QB? Chris, please listen closely to this message. If you want to win in fantasy football, if you want to win, not just enjoy playing, forget your fandom. Your fandom does not matter. I don't care if you're a Packers fan. My job is to tell you the right move, not the fun move. And the right move is absolutely to keep Alvin Kamara, Kareem Hunt, Mike Evans, and Rob Gronkowski. In the short term, you're looking at four top two round picks, while Aaron Rodgers will continue to be drafted in the third-ish round, even though that's still too early. You know quarterbacks are replaceable, and if not, I can send you to my other podcast, Living the Stream, which will show you week by week how unnecessary it is to spend at the quarterback position in fantasy football. You're dropping Aaron Rodgers, and you're keeping the other players because of their talent, situations, and upside. This next one is from @JustinRao23. How can we use net expected points per rush attempt and success rate for fantasy football? For example, last season, Bilal Powell was one of the most efficient runners, yet this year he was near the bottom. How can we use this information to make solid fantasy decisions? So for those of you who don't know what net expected points is, I did a podcast on it over last offseason with its creator, Keith Goldner, but it's NumberFire's expected points model. It helps show how many real points players are adding for their teams versus expectation. I love using rushing net expected points per rush in conjunction with success rate because it shows us efficiency versus consistency. Rushing net expected points per rush is the efficiency side, while success rate shows us the percentage of positive expected points runs made by a running back. So you're looking at how efficient they are and how often they are gaining positive plays. Both metrics are descriptive, not predictive. However, the reason you can utilize them for fantasy football is to find regression candidates. Bilal Powell was really good within the metric last year, and that offense and team changed dramatically this season. Things changed. You can't just expect one season's success to carry over to the next. However, you can look at someone like Alvin Kamara, who had insane efficiency with lower than expected success rate this year, and see that he's a regression candidate for next season. He's still going to be super useful in fantasy football, don't twist my words there, but he wasn't making plays as consistently as he should have, given his efficiency on the ground. Doing this exercise has spotted players regressing like Todd Gurley 2 years ago. But you always have to put that team context around the player because, like I said at the top, situation is amazingly important, especially for running backs. This next one is from @Arquadium. If you have an idea for a trade that you feel makes your team better but potentially makes the other team, quote, too stacked, is that enough to make you rethink the deal? In these type of situations, I'm looking out for myself first and foremost. And the reason I say that is because if I'm not making my team better just because another team will become really good, then I'm actually helping the rest of my league too, all while not making my own team better. That's not how you win. Of course, you don't want to create a powerhouse with the other team, so maybe try to ensure that you're getting a slightly better deal. But remember too, variance exists, so in a random head-to-head matchup, that powerhouse team can still lose. That, and the players that you traded, can still flop. This is all hypothetical, of course. It always depends on the circumstances, but overall, I look out for my team first. This next one is from @GameOfReindeers. What do you look for to determine dynasty market inefficiencies, and when is the best time in the offseason to trade? Right after the season, before the NFL draft, before the season, etc. One thing that I definitely do is look at general rankings that folks are posting and see where I feel most differently about players. If someone's really high in a player that I'm low on, I look to unload that player and vice versa. I also think fantasy owners are super reactionary. So I'll sell when I see regression hitting, and I'll buy when players simply underperform based on what looks to be flat-out luck. And you've also got to look at contract situations. If a player is becoming a free agent and that guy's thrived in his current situation, you might want to unload him if the team's looking like they're not going to re-sign him. Or if a player has a good prospect profile and showed glimpses of being a stud, but you know he was not in an ideal situation for his skill set, if he's going to be a free agent, then you buy him. Like I've been saying all podcast long, I am a big fan of buying into situations because mediocre players can thrive in those good situations, and even the most talented players can fall flat in good situations. So all of that comes into play when I'm buying and selling during the offseason. And I don't think that there's an ideal time to buy, per se, during the offseason. I think it all depends on that individual player's circumstances based on the variables that I just outlined. That's it for today's show, though, everyone. Thanks again for listening. If you've yet to subscribe to the show, do so by going to Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Google Play, and Stitcher. And please, if you have mailbag questions, hit me up on Twitter, @LateRoundQB, or email me at jj@numberfire.com. Thanks, everyone. I'll be back on Tuesday with a podcast looking at the process that I took on some of my biggest hits this year. If you didn't listen to the podcast on my biggest misses, I published that this past Tuesday. Until then, enjoy the divisional round of the playoffs this weekend.